have a bit of a story and controversial history. Beginning in the late 80s and in the early 90s, between the legislature and based upon jurisprudence from this court, there were statutory enactments that were put in place to ensure the constitutional due process concerns that were being raised by the case law. The statute that requires that a single jury decide both liability for as well as the amount of punitive damages is plain, it's unambiguous. We've cited the standard rules of statutory construction in our briefs, and application of those rules then mandate that a single jury decide both liability for as well as the amount of punitive damages. Second is authority from this court requires that a single jury decide both liability for as well as the amount of punitive damages. That authority is the Cantorino versus Mirage Hotel Casino case. It's a case that was decided in 2002, and I think that the procedural history of that case is instructive. In that case, it was a premises liability case. Two of the jurors who voted against liability were foreclosed from participating in the deliberations to determine the amount of damages. On appeal, this court upheld the liability determination and sent the case back then, or remanded the case, for determination as to the amount of damages. But the court allowed reconsideration of that decision before it went back to the trial court. And in the hearing on reconsideration, this court adopted the Perkins decision out of Arizona, stating that when the court reverses and remands for a new trial, then both liability as well as the amount of damages must be decided in that remand.
What about the order, the court 126 or 232P4-433? When is that different than the remand order? The remand order for a new trial on punitive damages, both the assessment and amount.
I believe it's found that it requires both the assessment liability for punitive damages as well as the amount of punitive damages. And I believe that the rationale underlying the Cantorino decision applies not only to compensatory damages, because that's what was at issue in the Cantorino case.
But in Cantorino, aren't you overruling Cantorino and Perkins a bit? In Cantorino, the issue was you had an 8-person jury, 6 voted in favor of liability, 2 said no way. They sent a note to the judge saying, "Judge, can the two who are against liability participate in damages without contacting the lawyers?" The judge said, "No." So then they get a 6-person jury on damages. So they didn't have the constitutional full jury. They only had whatever that is, 3/4 of the jury specified by law decide damages. So I think it's not quite clear to me, unless Arizona has taken Perkins further down this path, that it absolutely says that every time you reverse on damages, you're going to have a new trial on liability and damages. Do you follow my question?
I understand your question. In Perkins, the reason that the court in Perkins stated that when you remand them for a new trial, that you must decide both liability as well as the amount of damages. And the reason being is based upon the indeterminate nature of a jury's verdict. In other words, as the jury is going through its process and making determinations on whether or not to impose an award, it should be looking at all aspects, and all of the members then should be participating in that decision. Reprehensibility or culpability or blameworthiness has an impact on both the liability components as well as the amount of punitive damages. Those factors are the common denominator that are on both sides of that equation. So as a juror is looking at reprehensibility, blameworthiness, or culpability of the defendant in determining as to the amount of damages, it could revisit then the issue dealing with liability. And therefore, why, when there is a reversal and a remand, that it should be on both aspects. The third point, and this is one that I think is important in this particular case, especially.
So in a death penalty case, you would say, if you reverse that the errors in the penalty hearing, you would say the whole case has to be retried?
That was what the U.S. Supreme Court held in as far as in the bifurcated component, then dealing with criminal penalties, and so the answer to that would be yes. Now this also makes sense then in the context then of this particular case. If you have one jury being instructed upon as well as deciding liability and the amount of punitive damages, then they are given the instructions, all of the instructions, that have surrounded punitive damages in general. Number one, they would be told the punitive damages are the rare and exceptional case, that they're not designed to compensate a plaintiff, but they're designed for deterrence and to explain the purpose then behind punitive damages. Also, a single jury would be instructed upon the standards, the burden of proof, clear and convincing evidence of fraud, oppression, or malice. A single jury would get not only the standard, but also the definitions of those particular foundations or the right foundations for the imposition of that punitive damages. Also, a single jury then would give instructions upon when an employer can be held liable for the acts of its employee. Now that is particularly important in this case that had the home builder, D.R. Horton, as well as D.H.R. Mortgage at issue in the underlying trial. Also, you had at least 5 and 6 employees, but there was never a single finding as to whether or not that any of those individuals were managerial individuals so as to impose vicarious liability on DHI Mortgage. All you had for the jury in trial number 2 was this single instruction. That was the only substantive instruction the jury number 2 was given in this case. That's it. That's all. And therefore, what we submit is that not only did the court err in not allowing the jury to be instructed upon, but also to decide the issues of liability as well as the amount of punitive damage, was clear error on the part of the district court. The second point that I would like to address is the fact that the decision, the amount that was imposed, was constitutionally excessive.
Before you get there, is there evidence in the record of what the 2010 financials were that you sought to have admitted that were excluded?
We made an offer of proof as to those.
So that's in the record?
That is in the record.
When you sit down, could you get me that site?
I will do so,
yeah.
I think one of the key points to make as far as here is that the issue of whether or not that a jury's verdict is constitutionally excessive should apply, and that analysis applies even when the district court then remits it to the $300,000 statutory amount. That decision is, I think, made clear by the Countrywide case in this court, and also even by Bettinger 1, the decision that was issued in this very case, requires analysis because it cites then to the State Farm versus Campbell case for a due process analysis. And so my argument is going to focus then based upon the $300,000 amount of punitive damages. There are three factors that the court has taken a look at then that are supposed to be evaluated in determining whether or not an award may be excessive. The first factor is the ratio of compensatory damages to punitive damages. And it has been suggested by U.S. Supreme Court authority that a ratio of 1-to-1 may be appropriate. They've never applied a bright line test as to what is an appropriate ratio. They've analyzed factors. But in the Campbell case, they expressly make reference to a 1-to-1 ratio. The ratio in this case was 54-to-1, compensatory damages to punitive damages. That is excessive, especially when you compare it to what the other civil remedies or the other criminal penalties that may be applied under the Deceptive Trade Practices Statute. The other factor, the second factor that is supposed to be examined in excessiveness is the other civil penalties. The maximum civil penalty is $10,000. The maximum criminal penalty is treble the damages. Treble the compensatory, so 3-to-1 ratio. And the last factor that is supposed to be analyzed is the reprehensibility or the blameworthiness of the defendant. And in this case, I submit that DHI Mortgage, what did it do wrong? It followed the rules of its underwriter in deciding that Mr. Bettinger wasn't entitled to a primary rate interest loan. It followed the rules of its underwriter, which is somewhat ironic in this day and age when we now know what has contributed then to some of the economic downfall that we've had across the 2008 time frame. And so DHI Mortgage, what did it do? It followed the rules of its underwriter. And analyzing that conduct does not result then in a finding of reprehensible conduct that should be deemed to be punished. Therefore, I would like to submit here with the last 2 minutes for purposes of rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Medusa. Mr. Feldman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, opposing counsel. For purposes of the record, my name is David Feldman, here with Rusty Graff, counsel for the respondent cross appellate issue, Stephen M. Bettinger. For roadmap purposes, unless the Court directs me otherwise, first I'd like to address Mr. Bettinger's single cross appellate issue with respect to the $300,000 cap contained in NRS 42.005 and its infringement and violation of both the litigant's right to a jury trial as well as the separation of powers contained in Article 3, Section 1 of the Nevada Constitution, and then address the appellant's, DHI's, issue on the same statute, NRS 42.005, as it relates to due process, and then address the other appellate issues as counsel did. Does the Court need to hear a brief recitation of the facts?
No, I think we know them, unless any justices have questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. This Court and the U.S. Supreme Court has never at any time adopted a bright-line rule for a cap on punitive damages. In fact, such a rule has been rejected outright by the courts. However, the Nevada legislature, in the promulgation of 42.005, has done exactly that. And it's in conflict with the Article 3, Section 1, separation of powers and the exclusive problems of this court. Why a bright-line rule has not been adopted? Well, this isn't a one-size-fits-all proposition. There are several factors that are contained, that are contained in this court's decision, Bongiovi v. Sullivan, that are not contained in NRS 42.005. For example, Bongiovi deals with three different factors, the excessiveness test that was adopted actually from the Campbell v. State Farm decision. The first one is the comparability or the ratio between compensatory and punitive damages. That one is addressed by NRS 42.005, and that's where it ends. NRS 42.005 doesn't deal with the second of the three prongs, the degree of reprehensibility of the appellant's conduct. Was fraud involved? Was it not involved? Was it chronic? How many people were affected? How much did it affect the litigant? This is a one-size-fits-all statute that doesn't fit every situation, although this court has come up with a decision in Bongiovi v. Sullivan that does. The third prong is how does the punitive damages compare with other civil or criminal penalties that may exist? In this case, the court's aware of the facts. We have behavior of DHI Mortgage. It's tantamount to wire fraud and sending a phony loan application to the secondary market in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. We have misrepresentation and fraud with respect to the promise of a return of an earnest money deposit that was false. Evidence and actions tantamount to forgery. We have deceptive trade practices with a bait and switch. Had these been prosecuted criminally, the criminal would be facing years of jail because of the felony act. However, a corporation can't go to jail. The only weapon a litigant has with respect to punishing a corporation is punitive damages. Why do we have them? So a community can express, in the form of a jury, the citizens of Nevada, outrage for the reprehensible conduct of a litigant, and also to warn and punish them from doing this behavior in the future. Here the jury system spoke twice with respect to DHI. The first jury came up with an award of punitive damages of $1.5 million. This court, because of the exclusion of compensatory damages with respect to emotional distress, reduced the compensatory award. And the second jury went back, looked at the exact same evidence that the jury heard in the first trial, and deemed $675,000 was an appropriate measure of damages to warn this company, we will not stand for this behavior in this state. Well, the statute, unfortunately, doesn't cover the Bongiovi factors. There already exists in this court significant judicial controls to ensure that due process notions are complied with. First of all, the lower court has the ability to review the judgment to make sure that it complies with the notions of due process. This court has the same ability, of course, to review the judgment to make sure it complies with due process. So what does that leave us with NRS 42.005? It's incomplete because it does not address the other two factors contained in Sullivan, Bongiovi. And it's also redundant because we already have these judicially created checks and balances with respect to due process. Alternatively, Mr. Betzinger submits that a judicial exception to NRS 42.005 be created to punish intentional fraud designed for financial gain that shocks the consciousness of the court. And if this court were to adopt that rule today to a statute like NRS 42.005, it certainly wouldn't be alone. Other states, including Florida, Georgia, Ohio, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Alaska, Kansas, all have similar statutes to NRS 42.005 that have created a judicial exception to that for intentional fraud designed for financial gain.
Do their statutes enumerate specified categories that are exempt from the treble damage limit? I mean, from the $300,000 limit?
There are exceptions in some of those state statutes that I reviewed with respect to, for example, in this state we have an exception of caps
for products liability, for example, or insurance bad faith.
Insurance bad faith is the one exemption that we have here. Also, you have it for, like in a Bongiovi case, misrepresentation or slander.
But we have statutorily enumerated exceptions. My question to you is about the cases in other states. You just said that
right. Other
states have inferred an additional exception, such as intentional fraud calculated to get money.
Right.
But most fraud is. But in any event, do those states similarly have statutes that enumerate a series of express exceptions and the judiciary is putting in a new one?
You know, from my review, and it's only been, I believe, of Ohio and Alaska that have those exceptions, the answer to your court's question is yes, it does. However, I do not want to be incomplete to the extent the court has additional briefing on it. I'd be happy to address that.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
So we are. With respect to the appellant's issue of the $300,000 cap and due process, first of all, the Baker case they cite to is limited exclusively to maritime law with a 1-to-1 ratio. The counsel misspoke when she said that Campbell incorporated that by reference. It did not. This was exclusive to maritime. Campbell stated, what counsel did not point out, that it recognizes that when there's minimal nominal compensatory damages, that a ratio in excess of a single-digit ratio can be warranted that survived due process scrutiny. In fact, unlike Campbell wasn't a fraud case like this one. Campbell was an insurance breach of contract bad faith case. However, the U.S. Supreme Court, in reviewing a case that's like this one, TXO versus Alliance, where the jury came up with $19,000 in compensatory damages and $10 million in punitive damages, survived constitutional scrutiny for due process because it's different. It's, again, not a one-size-fits-all proposition. Fraud was involved, just like we have here. Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion for both TXO, Alliance, and Campbell, and, in fact, cited to it favorably in Campbell, supporting and underscoring that this is still the law of the land, and it's still appropriate analysis today because the degree of reprehensibility can be looked at in a fraud case to get past the single-digit ratio notion. The deterrent effect of punitive damages is frankly lost with a $300,000 cap. This is frankly an arbitrary number. It's going to be $350,000, it could be $400,000, it's arbitrary, it's not adjusted for inflation. It was promulgated in 1989, about 25 years ago. A wealthy company that commits intentional acts of fraud designed to gain money and fill its coffers is not going to be dissuaded by a $300,000 cap. Net profits were, not gross profits, net profits of DHI were over $108 million. $300,000 isn't even 1%. It's not 0.5%. It's 0.276% of 1%. This company is not going to be dissuaded from engaging in fraudulent conduct if that's their risk. Other states, Montana, Kansas, Mississippi, all base punitive damages on the net worth. How are you going to get a company's attention if they're limited to a cap? For example, Berkshire Hathaway, Microsoft, $300,000, they're not going to feel it. That's a mosquito bite on an elephant when that elephant really needs a good whack to get its attention. Most consumers don't have the wherewithal financially to prosecute a case where there's minimal compensatory net damages and maybe a chance for punitive damages. And whether it be unfortunate or not, most attorneys aren't going to take a case like that on contingency, and appellants know it. And really, the insidious aspect of a $300,000 cap on punitive damages is it may actually encourage and incentivize parties to engage in deliberate, foul, fraudulent conduct for the purposes of financial gain, because they know that the gains far outweigh the remote risks. Don't let Nevada be a refuge state for companies like that. With respect to the other appellate issue of not having the same jury trial, the appellant's argument should fail for two reasons. First of all, it's waived. This court, in its 2010 published opinion, gave us instructions and a protocol to follow with respect to having a trial on the limited issue of punitive damages. DHI never filed a motion under NRAC 40 for a reconsideration of this court's opinion. They had 18 days to do it. They did not. The purpose of going through and telling the parties, go with the second trial, have it on a limited issue of punitive damages, which we followed, and we did. To use this opportunity now is really a motion for reconsideration that's untimely. Also, the appellant, DHI, agreed to the protocol of reading the evidence from the first trial to the jury in the second trial. This is a protocol they agreed to. Second, having an entirely new trial on all issues, including liability, which is affirmed by this court, would be a procedure that undermines the judicial process. It's not practical. The jurors wouldn't be released from jury duty for years during the appellate process. Also, the statute, NRS 42.005, only addresses the circumstance we have a trial originally, where there's going to be an evaluation of compensatory damages and then punitive damages. It doesn't address this circumstance we have here today with respect to a retrial or a remand on the limited issue of punitive damages. So what body or branch of government has the opportunity to create rules of procedure when it's not addressed by the statute? Of course, this court does. The California Supreme Court had a very similar circumstance presented to them in Torres, which is Automobile Club of Southern California. It involved a statute similar to NRS 42.005. The legislature, the court determined, did not clearly express an intent to limit appellate courts like this one from their inherent ability to have a trial on a limited issue of punitive damages. In fact, the appellant doesn't lose any substantive rights in having this happen at all. There are certain protections that are involved. Obviously, the Nevada legislature can't tell this court you're not allowed to affirm decisions involved. You have the inherent ability to do that. The rationale adopted by that court was that in the context of retrials, it was generally unnecessary for the same jury to determine liability and punitive damages in order to ensure a reasonable relation between actual and punitive damages. Judicial economy is served. You're having the record where there's no issue, no error on the record, and the court passes on it and weighs on it and determines that there's no error like we did in this 2010 opinion, then it serves judicial economy because we're preserving and we're respecting the results of a trial on issues where there's no error. With respect to Wright v. Ford, that was a case, again, similar to this circumstance, where you had a limited trial or a retrial on a limited issue of punitive damages because out-of-state conduct was considered in that court, and that was inappropriate. The jury was read what the compensatory damages were in the first trial so they could have a reasonable relation to what the punitive damages should be. That's exactly what happened in this case, and it survived due process muster, because exemplary damages are just different than compensatory damages. Also, regarding the scope of the trial, this court's order, this opinion, was crystal clear that we're going back for a retrial for the limited purpose of assessing punitive damages because of the great reduction in compensatory damages. Liability was established. There was no motion for reconsideration, including issues about whether a manager affirmed the conduct, which it did in the form of Daniel Callahan. As such, an issue of liability is foreclosed and waived with respect to the appellant's argument. The issue about discovery, the 2010 financials, first of all, discovery was never reopened. Significantly, DHI had never filed a motion to reopen discovery in the second trial.
And the third, I'm a proponent of the punitive damages. I mean, it's really on you to put in contemporary evidence of net worth, right?
That is true, and that's exactly what we did in the first trial, and keeping it consistent with the second trial was paramount in keeping the same evidence that was assessed and weighed by the first jury. The issue, again, the time that they gained from their fraud was during this time frame that we used those
It's financials. Publicly traded company, right? That information is publicly available?
That's, I believe so. I believe we can either get it from Dun & Bradstreet or possibly other
Is that where you got the 2006 financials?
I believe that's correct.
Okay. So you came forward with the 2006 ones?
That's correct. And there's no competing financials that were provided by appellant DHI in that circumstance either. This is an issue in using punitive or using financial evidence later on. A party that's being sued for punitive damage, particularly when it's been caught and assessed the first time in trial, can do certain things when they know they're going to trial a year or 2 years or 3 years down the road. They can create a new company with a stream of income is being shifted to that new company. So it artificially looks like the network of the company isn't very good. They could wind it down. So the best evidence of the financial wherewithal of the company is the net worth of the company at the time of the first trial. The offer of judgment issue, first of all, it's untimely. They waited 9 months after this court's published opinion, which confirmed and reduced the amount of the judgment. This court's decision in Davidson v. Steffens said 3 months was too long. Here they waited 9 months. Significantly, they didn't beat the offer of judgment either, as supported in the appendix in our brief. The judgment, offer of judgment was $6,000. The compensatory damages for D.L. Horton was $5,190. However, that offer of judgment was tendered about a year after litigation commenced. As we supported in our brief, we had costs far in excess of that $1,000 or $800 gap. Attorney's fees were in excess of that $1,000 or $800 gap. They did not meet the offer of judgment. With respect, Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. I'd be happy to entertain any questions the court may have.
Any questions for Mr. Feldman, from anybody? Okay, Mr. Feldman, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Ms. Lundbaum.
What I'd like to do is to go back to the single jury issue that was addressed by Mr. Feldman. He claims that somehow that we had waived our right to assert this issue. And the reason that he claims that we waived our right to assert this issue is because this court's decision was crystal clear the first time around, and we didn't seek reconsideration of the court's first decision. Well, respectfully, I do believe that the court's decision was clear, but the other direction. This court expressly stated that the punitive damage award was vacated. It reversed and remanded for a new trial on the issue of punitive damages. And so therefore, in reading that decision, and when we originally presented it to the district court, she said, yes, I agree with you. The jury is going to be asked two questions. Do you want to impose punitive damages? And if so, in what amount? It wasn't until the day before trial started the second trial did she tell us she was collapsing those decisions in into a single question and only giving this instruction with dealing with the issue of punitive damages. Second, Mr. Feldman contends that somehow that we waived our right to assert this issue because we entered into a stipulation. The stipulation that we had entered into was very express. Witnesses at this point in time were gone. We agreed to present witness testimony through prior testimony, but that was it. We reserved our right to object to the introduction of that, as well as to offer additional testimony, and we did offer additional testimony as well as additional exhibits. The DHI's 2010 financial statements, Your Honor, can be found at the fifth volume of the Joint Appendix, 865 to 867. And we offered to allow discovery then into those 2010 financial records that were a matter of, not, I don't want to say public record, but they were available publicly because it is a publicly traded company.
Did you ask to reopen discovery, though?
We offered that to Mr. Feldman, and Mr. Feldman rejected that. We didn't need additional discovery. We have offered to the district court, if he believes he needs additional discovery on our 2010 financial statements, we will allow him to engage in that discovery. He didn't want that. He limited only as far as to present the issue of the 2006 financial records, not the 2010 financial records, Your Honor. Now, from the perspective
of... Just a second, Ms. Lumber, I think your time's up, but Justice Pickering had a question for you.
One quick follow-up. Could you, in a very capsule way, because your time is up and they only have 15 minutes, tell me the difference between the 2006 and the 2010 financial statements in terms of their likely impact on what the jury returned?
Well, from this perspective, Your Honor, I think that it meant night and day. In 2006, and when you take a look at where the economy was at that point in time, we had black ink. In 2010, we had red.
Okay.
We weren't alone. And so from that perspective, from the component of the jury, then, of what they selected, the 675, was the lowest amount that the defendants or the plaintiffs had asked for in their argument then, and they felt compelled that they must award something. And so they selected the lowest value that had been sought then by the plaintiffs.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Lundahl and Mr. Feldman, for your excellent arguments and briefs. And the court will take this matter under submission.